you, Dr. Benatti. Our first speaker this morning is Dr. Patricia Bamba. Dr. Bamba is a nationally recognized palliative care and end-of-life expert who designs and oversees the implementation of community projects. Dr. Bamba currently serves as the Vice President and Medical Director for Geriatrics for the Excellus Blue Cross Blue Shield organization. She served on the Institute of Medicine's committee that produced Dying in America, Improving Quality, and Honoring Individual Preferences Near the End of Life. She's a member of the newly formed National Academy of Medicine Roundtable on Quality Care for People with Serious Illness. Dr. Bamba chairs the Medical Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment, the MOLST, statewide implementation team, and the National Healthcare Decisions Day, New York State Coalition. And is a member of the Medical Society of the State of New York Ethics Committee and serves as the eMOLST Program Director. Dr. Bamba is passionately focused on educating the medical community and the public at large with a goal of improving the quality of life for seniors and their families. Dr. Bamba attended Immaculata College, the University of Virginia School of Medicine, and completed her residency training in internal medicine at the University of Rochester. She's board certified in both internal medicine and geriatrics, and has spent most of her career in private practice caring for frail elders and their families and their caregivers. She is a clinical assistant professor of medicine at the University of Rochester and the State University of New York Upstate Medical University. Dr. Bamba returns to our program today to provide us with an update on MOLST and eMOLST. Welcome, Dr. Bamba.
First and foremost, thank you for the kind introduction. It's a real pleasure to be back here, and it's very interesting as I looked at the audience, there are many familiar faces. I want to start by thanking Milmick and also Fager and Ansler for the support that they've given to the MOLST and now eMOLST program since inception. And in particular, I want to point out Donnie Richman, who's a member of Fager and Ansler. Donnie, can you raise your hand? Donnie has been a member of the Monroe and Onondaga MOLST implementation team that helped to make MOLST a state program and helped us to affect legislative change. And she's been a member of the MOLST statewide implementation team and the National Healthcare Decisions Day New York State Coalition. So I thank you for all of the support you've given and look forward to continuing support over the future. And I have to really acknowledge our company that has supported the development of MOLST and eMOLST since inception, aside from a small amount of dollars from a HEAL grant to start with the first prototype of eMOLST. So there's a lot to cover, and I got a little slow start here in terms of my time, so I'm going to be going very quickly. We're going to allow enough time for questions, and there's some tools that I've included at the end slides as well as in your packet. There's a lot of information that as risk managers you can share with the facilities that you represent, and you can also be ambassadors to help us in keeping of the theme so far for today on the digital transformation of MOLST to eMOLST. So we're going to talk about some national trends, give you a brief background on the MOLST, including changes in public health law. We're going to talk today about where there are failures, and that have come really out of the conversations that I've had with Donnie and others across the state to be able to show where the paper MOLST isn't working, because it was never designed to be a form. It's a real process. The form is the end of the process, and some recommendations for improvement, including implementation of eMOLST. We'll talk about what eMOLST is and show how it aligns with the new movement to basically innovative payment models, including value-based payment, including DSRIP. I want to start by showing and talking a little bit about palliative care, because that's a buzzword out there today, both across our state and nationally. People have a hard time understanding what is palliative care. Palliative care is hospice care. It's end-of-life care. But it really is, in combination with chronic disease management, the best care and the kind of care each and every one of us need to be advocating, not only for people with advanced illness, but for ourselves and we're building that as we move forward. Community doesn't understand it. What I've underlined is a definition that came out of a national survey to help people to simplistically understand it's interdisciplinary care that focuses on improving the quality of care that people receive and an extra layer of support for both the person and their family. That resonates when I talk in communities, and I go simply and talk about three key pillars. Advanced care planning is one key pillar. And with that, doing healthcare proxies for the entire population 18 and older is important, and identifying the subgroup that's appropriate for MOLST. Once the MOLST is done, you need a palliative care plan. You need to identify pain and symptom management. If people don't want to go back to hospital and you want to reduce an unwanted hospitalization, you better have a good care plan and also educate the caregivers and families. You can't put a pink form on top of a refrigerator, even those created by eMOLST, and not have family and the healthcare agent know what it means. So caregiver support is important. The biopsychosocial and spiritual and existential elements overlie all of those three key pillars. Another way to look at it, and I would say if you read the literature, throw out the term curative. I've been a geriatrician for 40 years, and I've never cured ALS, Alzheimer's dementia, end-stage heart failure. But I have managed chronic illness, and it should be combined with those three key pillars from the time of diagnosis. Frankly, I don't want to wait. If I end up with metastatic cancer, I don't want to wait till I'm in hospice to get good pain management. If I have an illness that gives rise to chronic pain, I want to have a good care plan that doesn't mean I'm opioid addicted if I don't have a chronic illness, but I have a other illness that relates to chronic pain, be it back pain, migraines, etc. But all of this comes along. This linear line represents the surprise question. Would it surprise you if this person dies in the next year? Physicians are not good on prognostication, but we can do it. And the way I always did it is, I don't know the date and time when you're going to die, but I can tell you it wouldn't surprise me if you die in the next year. The next 6 months, let's evaluate you for hospice, etc. I've seen enough people where I've been called into consult in ICUs, where they've been in the ICU for four weeks, and I've called on a Sunday as the charging person on the white horse to save the day, and that person's actively dying. We need to be able to have conversations and actually talk about it. So that's the surprise question. That's the linear question. Would it surprise you if they die in 6 months? That's death, and this is bereavement. Over this period of time, look at the math. Look at the area under the curve. Closer coming to the end of life, those key pillars are much more valuable than all of the chronic disease management that we do. So it's our professionalism for the physicians that are there, and I see some of the faces of physicians I know. It is all about our professionalism. It's taking a time out to be the physician that we said we would be. And that holds true for the other members of the team within scope of practice. Over that time period, goals will change. I have started these conversations without MOLST multiple times in my practice. No one has said to me when I said it wouldn't surprise me that you might die in the next year, oh, that's fine. Let's see what I'm going to do. Everybody wants more time. So the goal usually starts with longevity. Then over time, particularly with my seniors, it focuses on functionality. I want to age in place. I don't want to end up in the nursing home. And then finally moves to quality. So think about that, because that's very important as you think about the form. MOLST is a set of medical orders. It's not static. And as those goals change, the MOLST will change. That's the reason for pages 3 and 4. And I'm saying that because we're seeing MOLST forms that have no review and renew, even with care transitions, and it makes it very, very difficult. So let's talk quickly about Dying in America. Dying in America was a two-year project. I was privileged to be on that committee. At the end of the day, this is a 500-page document. If you have not taken the time to read it, there's a Cliff Notes version that you can get the high level of the recommendations and then dive deeper into it. The bottom line is that we need to face the challenges of really advanced illness and people dying and the cost of care at the end of life. It's a national priority. We're bankrupting our states, and we have a burgeoning aging population that I've talked about for 40 years. The time to do it is now. And it has to be blended with compassionate care for not only the patient, but for the family. We have to do it in a way that families are not broken apart and depressed and bereaved afterwards. There are five key areas in the report. The first is on person-centered, family-oriented care. It talks about blending medical and social services, and that really is making sure that we are taking care of the person. We can do all of the congestive heart failure meds and all the treatments, and if they can't get access to good food, how are we going to take care of them? So that's really what that is about. The second is on advanced care planning and moving away from forms to really the focus that we've had in New York State, particularly upstate, on communication. Early communication, early discussion of goals and care, and focusing on healthcare proxies, identifying those people appropriate for medical orders. To be able to do that, you need to be able to have good education and supporting shared decision making, professional clinician training for our physicians, our nurse practitioners, our nurses, social workers, clergy, as well as public education. And all of the recommendations, some of which I'll touch on today, can only be supported by good public policy change and payment reform. So one of the recommendations is that it's encouraging every state to develop and implement a physician orders for life-sustaining treatment program, paradigm program in accordance with national core requirements. I want to define some terms for those of you not familiar, because I don't want you to end up saying, what is a pulse? What is a MOLST? National pulse paradigm is the process, the communication process, the ethical framework, the discussion that comes before completion of a form. So that's the program. Different states have different names. And frankly, New York, and I was part of the founding of the National Pulse Paradigm Task Force, it's because of New York that different states have different names, because our laws were complex enough in terms of patient protection. We did review and renew. We basically had supplemental forms to document 4 pages for adults, 4 for kids, the public law that just accounted for DNR regulations, and the people in Oregon said, whoa, that's too complex. Use our model, but take a different term. And frankly, medical orders makes more sense. They're not the physician's orders, they're the medical orders for the person. So if you're in Louisiana, this program's called La Poste. And I've been privileged with grant support to mentor their state. They're now an endorsed state. If you're down in North Carolina, it's MOST. If you're in Kansas City, it's TPOP. Don't ask me how they got that name. But we're MOST in New York. We are an endorsed pulse paradigm program. We started this work in 2001. This is a first map as of 2006 with endorsed states. Started in Oregon, went to Washington, New York State, West Virginia, the area around Pittsburgh, and La Crosse, Wisconsin. So these are the states that founded the National Pulse Paradigm. This is the work today. And so we're working very hard. We have the data. We just need to make the time to write so that we in New York can be an endorsed state. But we did not have the penetration, particularly in downstate in Long Island. So we're working very hard. We now have it through a grant that we're working with and supporting IPRO in partnership to work on eMOLST implementation on Long Island. Going to go quickly through this. Those of you who have seen me talk before know this slide. This represents advanced care planning as a process illustrating the health illness continuum. It's written about in the IOM report. It should start when we're young and healthy at 18. This is not an age-related slide because we know that we have healthy and independent older adults and we have babies born dying. This really represents health illness continuum, and as we move through that trajectory on the way to death, that our goals will change. Who we ask to represent us to be our healthcare agent changes. Who we choose at 18 may not even be alive at 50, much less 85. We have life experiences. Here's where the surprise question is. Would it surprise you if you die in the next 12 months? And I have questions at the end I'll show you to identify people appropriate for MOLST. This is hospice eligible. This is where the majority of people who are appropriate for MOLST. It is not for the entire population. I repeat that because there are enough people out there, physicians, who are doing it on everyone 65 and older. I take offense to that. It was never designed to be an advance directive on steroids put into their attorney's, file and pulled out when there's an emergency. And these are bright people who are doing it. And so it needs to be looked at for the right population. And look at death statistics. 150,000 people per 2014 died in New York. 10% of those are sudden death. That means 135,000 people. Of that, 110,000 people are seniors. 2,000 are children. This is a optional program, so everyone won't do it. So we don't expect that many forms, but we also expect that over time there will be more because the nursing home population is appropriate. And so there will be people who live longer than a year. But they are appropriate for most because if we don't get the flu vaccine right, people will end up with pneumonia and end up in hospital where they will die. We also have a smaller group on this side, and these are older adults who have really distinct ideas of what they want to receive and what they don't want to receive, and that changes over time. I cannot quantify that necessarily from statistics. So at the end of that process, we have two different kind of forms. These are advanced directives, and you know that the healthcare proxy is the major one in our state. And it also is really what is advocated nationally. Living wills done when you're 18 do not reflect what the heck you want at 85. And they don't work in an emergency situation. They're hard to interpret because no situation is purely terminal and irreversible. A person with end-stage dementia who has an aspiration pneumonia has an end-stage disease, end-stage dementia, potentially reversible aspiration pneumonia, ends up in the emergency room. The living will basically is not going to be trumped because you brought the person into the emergency room, you're asking for treatment, the medical team is going to treat the aspiration pneumonia. If it doesn't work, they will be placed on a ventilator, which is said not what they want. That's where most works, and it's building on our DNR statute from 1987. You know this is process. This is the end of the form. But it's really a standardized clinical process that we put into place in 2005 with the ethical framework to support it and the legal requirements that were written into public health law. This is the process. It's only step 7 when you complete the form. You have to prepare for the discussion. I spoke to a physician from Crystal Run yesterday in Orange County talking about how do we educate and implement EMOLS for their 500 providers. Who does the discussion? The primary care physician or the oncologist or the cardiologist when you're co-managing a person? You got to talk about that. My answer is, who does the person trust to have that conversation? And let's make sure those physicians are really able to do it. So we did it in 2005, revised it in 2011 to comply with New York State public health law, but it's preparing. What does the family know? Goals and hopes, realistic goals. Many conversations I started with, I don't want to die. We're all going to die. It means people have unfinished business. That's why social workers are part of the team. Everyone has to do their work in terms of scope of practice. And I'm saying that. Is that new? No. Is it important for you? Yes, because we have enough physicians that are turning the pink form to a social worker in the nursing home to say, get the orders. And when the good social workers who say, I don't want to lose my license, call me, I say, give me the name of the physician. So I do a little risk management work and say, hello, Dr. X, would you ask the social worker to choose the antibiotics for that pneumonia or the pressure sore? And then it becomes clear that the physician did not understand these are medical orders. So there's a lot of basic blocking and tackling, even though this is an update. And shared decision-making has to be well-informed. You need to be able to manage conflict, and the easiest way to manage it is to focus on the patient and their goals, complete the form, and the review and renew periodically. According to public health law, but also at times of care transitions, when patients' health status has changed, when their goals change, when they've changed their mind. So that's why we have page 3 and 4. What's the difference since I was here last? It was pretty simple. You could do most if you had capacity. If you didn't, you needed to have a healthcare proxy. If you didn't have that, you needed clear and convincing evidence. 3 pathways. 2010, the world went upside down with Family Healthcare Decisions Act, And we were also able to get the commissioner of OPWDD to approve use of the MOLS for that population, not only in hospitals on brink of death, but to bring it out to the community. We now have 7 checklists, and I worked with the health department to develop these, and one of those is with OPWDD, that really outlines 1750B. This is complex. It really takes all of what's written into the law for patient protection. But I will tell you, and I tell physicians, if I was in practice today, I couldn't keep this straight. You know, how do you do clinical determinations? Where are there special requirements? This is important because that's what we built into the EMOL system that we'll talk about. It's very, very hard to be able to know it and to make sure there's sustainable education, because we expect this will change because the New York State Task Force on Life and the Law put out its report as mandated by Family Healthcare Decisions Act to look at the blending of surrogacy laws for Family Healthcare Decisions Act in 1750B. It may take time. It may not be in my lifetime, since it took 18 years for Family Healthcare Decisions Act to be done, but someday it will be done, and we will update EMOLST to make it easier and to be the easy way for physicians to be able to learn it, do it right, and do something I was taught very early as a physician. If you don't document, it didn't happen. And so that's a part of the MOLS program. The care plan to support MOLS is really important. I said it earlier, but you have to be able to have the care plan, and you have to educate consumers, the family, the caregivers. Example, person with COPD doesn't want to be intubated any longer because they barely got off the ventilator the last time they were in the hospital. So they're going home with a MOLS form that says no more hospitalizations, no more intubations. They're going to go home with oxygen and morphine. If you don't educate that family in today's world that morphine is the best medication to treat shortness of breath along with oxygen, they're going to think they're going to kill grandma. She's going to become an addict. They may not get the prescription. You're not going to reduce that unwanted hospitalization. Simple example, but there are many others that I teach. Here's the law. I mentioned earlier that 2005 is when we started to the community pilot, but the idea started in the community with clinicians and the public working together to say, how can we ensure that people get what they want at the end of life? And that's how we found the PULSE model in Oregon and built New York's MOLST. That started in 2001. We started the creation of the form from 2001 to 2003. 2004, we started working in Rochester, very quickly followed by Syracuse, because the docs here recognized the value. Worked with the health department, did a pilot from 2005 to 2008. Important thing that happened with that pilot in these two counties: we changed the scope of practice for EMS. They can now follow DNR and DNI orders in the community. 2009, we got a HEAL 5 grant, small amount of money to build the first prototype for EMOLS. 2010, Family Healthcare Decisions Act went into effect. The health department made MOLS their form. The commissioner approved the MOLS for persons with developmental disabilities who lack capacity in 2011. The registry really was updated to comply with public health law in 2011, and we really started in the fall of that year, but with really full blast in 2012. We tried to build it as a Rio-centric model, regional health information organization, and replicated, and we found you see one Rio. So we started working across the state pretty much in 2013. 2015, CMS awarded IPRO, our quality organization for CMS here in New York State and 13 other states, a special innovation project grant on Long Island, where we had the least penetration of MOLS, where we're working on EMOLS implementation supported by clinician training and public education. I didn't put it on the slide. 2016, Assemblyman Morelli and Senator Funke introduced two companion bills, same bill, the EMOLS registry bill. It's in the health committee now. What it does is establishes in statute the EMOLS registry that exists. Secondly, it adds MOLS into public health law. It's important because when lawyers, they're not all sitting in this room, are looking for MOLS in LegalZoom, they say, I don't see it there, so it's not public health law. God help them if they read the regs from DOH, where it is. So we're putting that in, and we're also saying mandatory submission to the registry, and you'll be able to see as I continue the talk and finish up today why that is important. Not mandatory completion by any senior, mandatory submission, and we hope that that will drive more EMULS utilization so we can build on what you said earlier, and we move this digital, move to the digital platform, because the dual world of paper and digital is not where we need to be, and it keeps me up at night. Public health laws that you need to be aware of, healthcare proxy law, MOLST, Family Healthcare Decisions Act, and Surrogate Decision Making Improvement Act are the underpinning legislation and public health laws for end-of-life decisions that apply with or without MOLST. So if you have facilities that say, I don't like that MOLST, you can tell them they have to still follow the rules. They cannot be cowboys and cowgirls and just ignore the law. What the MOLST does is it's a community approach. One form, the only form under public health law that EMS can follow both DNR and DNI. You cannot use the non-hospital DNR form and add DNI. EMS cannot follow it. So that's really the value. The Palliative Care Information Act, as you know, all hospitals, all physicians and nurse practitioners are obliged to talk about end-of-life decisions. They comply with this by following MOLST because it is really all about palliative care, as I described it. And the Palliative Care Access Act, as you know, hospitals, nursing homes, and certain assisted living facilities need to have access to palliative care, policies and procedures, et cetera. This is what it takes to build a program, and clearly it is about thoughtful discussion, shared decision-making, and care planning, what I talked about, but it's also about culture change. It's about that training for the physicians and the clinicians. It's about public education. It's also about system implementation, policies, procedures, workflow. And the workflow is important as I talk a little bit later about the CPT codes, the new CPT codes for advanced care planning. And as we found in our pilot here in Syracuse and Rochester, you need dedicated physician and system champions. And we're identifying those for EMULST as well. And I have a dedicated EMULS champion from Orange County, and I want her to raise her hand, Emma Thadikoff. She is a palliative care physician who is driving EMULS in that whole county. And it really came back to working with Donnie and saying, who's the person that's in charge of risk management? And it was Marianne Walker. And I spoke with Marianne and others at Orange Regional, but Emma has been the driving force, and the rest of the team at Orange Regional have been the system champions. That's what it takes, and I'm identifying that to give you practical things when you have hospitals saying, we can't do this. For the physicians, it does take time. Over the course of the time I've worked with this and talked to physicians, I don't have time, I don't get paid, and frankly, I don't know how to do it. So we've been working to try to remove those barriers because this is what it takes, and it doesn't have to be done in one setting. It can take a long time, particularly if people have not done early advanced care planning, and the first introduction to this whole process is when they're at end of life. So that's what I tell people to take a look at. The IOM report said we have to overcome this barrier nationally and said let's provide some incentives for shared decision-making. And effective January 1st, and I'm sure you've heard about this, the CPT manual and AMA produced the codes, and CMS approved its use for Medicare and Medicaid members. It's 99497, 99498. It reimburses healthcare professionals who are providing services to Medicare and Medicaid members for advanced care planning. I talk nationally a lot, and I've done 3 conferences this year. One was specifically on this because NHPCO, the National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization, saw one of my webinars that we put on YouTube and said, please come down and educate. And I can tell you, people were talking about doing MOLST education or MOLST basic completion in the community with community health workers. This is the job of physicians and other clinicians. You know, this is so complex that we cannot expect. And that came out at the national conference I was at earlier this week. When are we going to pay them? It's like, it's fine for advanced care planning and the work we do with the NHDD New York State Coalition, but not for medical orders. What I try to tell physicians and other clinicians is advanced care planning is an integral component of the practice of medicine. These codes help to overcome that. And so there's a lot of detail. I'm happy to address any questions. This is the description, I'm not going to read it because you can read, that comes right out of the CPT manual. We at Excellus are very familiar with this. Why? Because we saw those barriers and created a model in 2009 that we linked to training. We just got rid of it and have to adopt that because if there are new codes, we adopted it. We used previous codes before. It talks about discussions. It can include the completion of the form, but discussion is really at the underpinning of this process. One thing that they did in the codes that is important if you have, and the reason I put this slide up, if you're getting questions, it's important to know that advanced directives are not the same as medical orders. Let's go through some quick ethics cases to see what's happening today. Resident came into a rehab facility. Healthcare proxy was really done in the hospital. One of six kids were listed as the healthcare agents. Others were alternates. No signature, no mark, no documentation, not even the type of aphasia. No MOLST was done, no documentation, values, and beliefs. Suffered a catastrophic stroke in the rehab facility, could not meet interqual criteria, was transferred to a custodial care. Resident was not alert, healthcare proxy not valid. Goals of care quickly shifted for more time, recovery from stroke to quality of life. Conflict. Let's remove the feeding tube. We're going to have the goals, focus on quality. 5 out of 6 kids were together with it. 1 was not. Ethics consult, legal counsel, and I was called. Patients in hospice. The value of MOLST is upstream to prevent some of this information and to be able to get everyone on the same page in the hospital, really working on it in terms of Family Health Care Decisions Act and really learning how to do conflict resolution. It's more than just a form. Another case is an 82-year-old woman who has multiple medical problems, frailty, all gets all of her care in one system. There's no information in the other system. She comes in, she's hospitalized in early December, transferred to the nursing home for rehab. MOLST is done. It says CPR and DNI. Those are incompatible orders. If a frail person, you know, wants CPR, they also are getting the whole enchilada. No feeding tube. Hospitalized in January in another system. I'm called from the city to see, was that a valid MOLST form? I said, first and foremost, it wasn't. Illegible handwriting, you can't do anything. In the hospital, a DNR and DNI order are ordered in the emergency room. No documentation, no discussion. Family comes in as irate. They say the person never had the ability to make decisions either in the nursing home or in the emergency room. They say, we want full treatment till we understand what's going on. She develops acute respiratory distress, is intubated, and when the dust settles, the family says, if we had had this discussion earlier, she would never have been intubated. But from our own background and beliefs, we have problems with withdrawing. We would have not had a problem not instituting. So again, the value of doing the process correctly. And I got called mostly because staff had intense moral distress. And they had to have an ethics consult, not even just about the case, but really to help manage the stress. Another case, 88-year-old woman sent from the nursing home to the ER, dementia, paralysis of all 4 extremities from strokes, horrible pressure sore, osteomyelitis, septic shock, no family, no healthcare agent. She has a non-hospital DNR form, no MOLST. Intubated and admitted to the ICU. Clearly the system did not understand the difference between a non-hospital DNR and a MOLST form. And here's a quote from the staff. From the chart, the poor woman was an extremist and doing her utmost to cast off her earthly shackles. Another nursing home resident's advanced dementia, no MOLST, no CPR. Hospital inserts a PEG tube only after the physician says, if you don't use a PEG, you'll starve your mom. This is not evidence-based. The evidence-based for not putting a feeding tube into a person with advanced dementia has been around for more than a decade. It's also been advocated as the number one recommendation by the Choosing Wisely campaign. She was continuing to try to pull it out. Daughter wanted it put out. Basically, in teaching, how do you begin to support the daughter? And this is a real case that I worked on with Donnie, resident from an OPWD residential facility, a rare syndrome on dialysis, bone marrow transplant, hospitalized, refused, dialysis starts acting out, Moles discussion, everything is done, everything is fine, until the psychiatrist suggests medicating the resident in order to resume dialysis. In this restraint-free state, this is a chemical restraint. Physician orders the hospital to resume dialysis. Hospital refuses, clarifies Moles 1750D process. Working with the risk manager, the physician accused the risk manager of euthanasia if dialysis was not resumed. These are the kind of cases that I know that you're working with. And dialysis was not being done correctly. It was periodic because of the acting out. So these are the real cases we're seeing. It's about end-of-life decision-making and how it can be done. Why are there failures? Because people aren't aware of their obligation to follow Moles, the implications of failure. Advanced care planning is not seen as a process, it's seen as a forum. Sometimes people are paying attention to the discussion on goals of care, not the other way of the process, but the form doesn't get done. Or someone starts the process and the physician never signs the orders, doesn't really basically do what we say, which is, at the very least, you need to be able to affirm that discussion, talk to the family. Sometimes it's avoiding those early discussions, and then you have these end cases, these horrible situations, or sometimes the wrong healthcare agent is chosen, and that person cannot help manage conflict or really effectively manage the situation. What I'm seeing with some of the physicians, they don't get the difference between advanced directives and medical orders. They don't document capacity, other legal requirements, or there's no accessibility. So our recommendations are really to strengthen clinician training, public education, and expand eMOLST. eMOLST is basically an electronic completion system. It's a web-based application. It's secure. We enroll people to be part of the conversation and part of the discussion based on their clinical and administrative use. It combines this process, all of the legal framework, to produce not only the MOLST, but also the documentation. It is part of the registry. Simply put, across care transitions, because no one physician is following the person everywhere, the receiving physician can access information not only about what the person wants, but why they want it. And it was highlighted in the IOM report, and I'm going to tell you that there's a lot of tools out there to help. Jonathan Carmel, less than 3 minutes, he basically says, advocates for eMOLST. Who in this room does their taxes in pencil and paper? Because if you do, you're apt to make mistakes. eMOLST provides 100% accuracy. There's no way to make a mistake. This is a video from a physician who's used it for 3 years. She talks about it from a physician's perspective. This gives a case in terms of forgetting it on the refrigerator, moving from upstate to downstate, and access through the registry. Because access is in all sites of care. Currently, EMS does not have access, and they don't want it until we get our providers to put it in. I'm going to end with this case and tell you that there's a lot of tools and slides that I won't cover. This is a real case from the North Country, a small critical access hospital where I got to meet an 80-year-old woman who basically thanked me for the eMOLST system. Her husband was 82, came into the hospital, had a MOLST discussion, pink form stayed on the refrigerator. He had congestive heart failure, COPD, one lung out for lung cancer, and he came in with respiratory failure. He didn't have the MOLST form. He was about to be intubated and shipped down here to Upstate Medical University. And the doc was trained and enrolled in eMOLST. He checked the system where it said DNR, DNI. He was not intubated, treated conservatively, and he died peacefully 2 months later. I got to meet his wife, who said, thank you. I know my husband would have died in that ICU 100 miles away from me. Quality, honoring preferences, adds value. And why does it add value? Because quality is going to drive down some of the costs for unwanted treatments. It's not about anything aside from that. So I thank you, and I'm sorry I didn't get through the rest of the slides.
Are there any questions for Dr. Bamba? As we're recording today's program, we would just ask you to wait until Joyce gets to you with the microphone so that we can get both the question and the answer recorded. Any questions? Okay, then we're going to move on to the first door prize. And our first door prize of the day is a $50 Amazon gift card. And I'm going to ask Dr. Bamba, after I stir these up a little bit, to do the honors and draw and announce the name of the first winner.
Here, come on. So the first winner is Dr. Andrew Ogden. Dr. Ogden? Congratulations.
We're not going to have a 15-minute refreshment break. Again, the refreshments are right outside this door. And that will bring us right back on time, and we'll start promptly at 11:15. Thank you.